Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on RadioMD or iHeart, wherever you download us from. Thank you very much. 50,000 of you a week can't be wrong. And this is an important one. This is 1190, and it is one of the people who probably deserves, if not the Nobel Prize, whatever is it, the next closest. He's the developer of the rotavirus vaccine, which has clearly helped save illness and maybe death in millions worldwide. Paul Offit is the director, is a physician director of the Vaccine Education Center at one of the three best children's hospitals in the world, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. My son, in a biased way, I've got to say this, is also at that institution and always says it's one or two. Rhys R. Hillman, professor of vaccinology and professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, is Paul Offit's official title. But as I said, he's the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine for children, a frequent guest on morning shows and the morning news shows, but also a member of the FDA Advisory Committee on Vaccination. Are you also a member of the CDC?
I was a member of the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practice in the early 2000s, but no longer.
So I didn't know if you're allowed to be on both. There are some rules against being on both at the same time, I think, in any case. So thank you for all you've done. The book we're talking about is Tell Me When It's Over. The subtitle, An Expert's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World. And it's just come out. And there are several areas that are really outstanding in this book that I want to highlight. But it is what I call kind of it should be the talk show host's mandatory reading, because it is so important and so informational. A couple of the things, Paul, you go into long COVID. I don't think we're going to have much time to go into that. And you go into a whole bunch of other subjects, the origin of the nightmare, where this originated from. You go into a whole bunch of where the FDA made some mistakes, et cetera. But I want to go into two issues that I get asked about a lot. One is, why is this different? And will it be just like another influenza in the long run that we get vaccinated against every year and don't take very seriously as long as we get vaccinated?
Well, I think the first part is what made this particularly dangerous was that there was a pandemic coronavirus SARS-1 that raised its head in 2002, killed thousands of people and it was spread across much of the world, but no one in the United States died. Same thing with MERS, a second coronavirus raised its head in 2012, no one in the United States died. And the reason was is that when you got those infections, those two coronavirus infections, you were sick. And so it was very easy to tell who was sick and who wasn't and who to stay away from and to put a moat around those who were sick. Not true with this virus.
So you weren't, let me clarify that. So you weren't infectious to others without being sick.
That's right. There was really no mild or asymptomatic infection, interestingly. That's not true for SARS-CoV-2. SARS-CoV-2, you could transmit this virus asymptomatically. So everybody you came in contact with in 2020, before we had anything, before we had antivirals, before we had monoclonals, before we had vaccines, was potentially someone who could infect you and kill you. And that scared us. We were a blank slate. We had no immunity. And that virus was killing 1,000 people a day, 2,000 people a day, 3,000 people a day. And we had nothing to stop it other than to limit human-to-human contact. So we shut down businesses and shuttered schools and restricted travel and isolated, quarantined, and masked and basically eliminated influenza and RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, from this country, which tells you how much worse COVID would have been had we not done those things. So I think that's what particularly made it dangerous, was its ability to be transmitted asymptomatically.
So that's one of the things that makes it much more dangerous than, if you will, the other COVID viruses. Is it more dangerous than the flu? Do you think it will be more dangerous than the flu long term?
So 2 years before SARS-CoV-2 came into this country in 2020, influenza caused 800,000 hospitalizations and 60,000 deaths. Do I think now that we have 98% population immunity with SARS-CoV-2, do I think that SARS-CoV-2, this virus, will settle into the panoply of winter respiratory viruses like respiratory syncytial virus, which kills 10 to 14,000 people a year, or influenza, which kills anywhere between 20,000 and 60,000 people a year? I think it probably will. I mean, it certainly continues to evolve and become immune evasive. But its immune evasiveness really has more to do with its immune evasive for protection against mild infection than severe infection. For the most part, people who have had, say, 3 doses of this vaccine or 2 doses of the vaccine in a natural infection, assuming they're young and healthy, appear to be able to be protected against severe disease at least for years, and we'll see how long that lasts.
You go through, I think, 6 other reasons why this is different in the book, and I don't want to let people know that it's a simple answer that you've given. That's because we're on a podcast. You go into much greater depth and importance of the other aspects in the book. And I do want to point out to people that the book, Tell Me When It's Over, is really exceptional. Do you think we'll be getting almost a combined influenza? In other words, RSV is one vaccine for the rest of life. Shingles vaccine may be one vaccine for the rest of life if you're an adult. The measles vaccine for kids, the chickenpox for kids looks like it's one for life. Will we be getting one COVID vaccine for life or one SARS vaccine for life? Or do you think we'll have to get one yearly like we do for the influenza?
It's a great question. When you have diseases that have long incubation periods, incubation period defined is the time from when you're exposed to when you develop symptoms. For the most part, you can develop vaccines that induce long-lived, arguably lifetime immunity, like measles, mumps, rubella, varicella. I mean, those are long incubation periods. In fact, those are the kind of diseases that you can eliminate from the face of the earth. Smallpox is a long incubation period disease. Measles is a long incubation period disease. So you can actually eliminate those diseases. Not true for short incubation period diseases. I mean, even if everybody in the world was immunized against SARS-CoV-2 and the virus never evolved to create variants, that virus would still spread in the community. I mean, rotavirus is a perfect example. Rotavirus is a disease of children. That virus is pretty stable. It doesn't really mutate away from protection induced by natural infection or by vaccination. 95% of children are vaccinated against this virus. I would say most pediatricians at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia have never seen a case of severe rotavirus disease, but the virus still circulates in the community, still causes mild disease, and it still causes children to come into the emergency department. I think that's probably where we're heading with this virus. We've morphed from a yearly booster dose to now sort of a yearly campaign like flu, where everybody over 6 months of age is recommended to be vaccinated. We're pretty much the only country that does that. All other countries, European countries, Scandinavian countries, Australia, the World Health Organization really recommends that vaccine, SARS-CoV-2, for high-risk groups, meaning people who are elderly, people who have high-risk medical conditions, people who are pregnant, people who are immunocompromised, to focus on those, because that's really who's getting hospitalized and who's dying, those groups. So wouldn't it make more sense to target those groups?
Now, I'm going to go flip way to the back of the book. We're skipping a huge amount of the book. The book, again, a wonderful book. And believe it or not, although it's a medical book and written with a very high scientific tone, it still is a relatively quick read. I think it's a great, well-written book, Paul. So if you wrote this without an editor, it's exceptional writing. So thank you. But the book is called Tell Me When It's Over, by Paul Offit, O-F-F-I-T, subtitle, An Expert's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World. And I am going to ask you how to motivate more. I'm scared of what's happening in the avoidance of vaccines now. But one of the later chapters is, can we make a better COVID vaccine? So for the first, as I've told you, neither my wife or I have gotten the COVID-19, despite my caring, and she cares for kids. She's a developmental pediatrician, which is why her son is a pediatrician, and she won that battle as opposed to, I take care of old people, trying to keep them young. We've, I think, together had 10 COVID shots in total, but the first four were all mRNA vaccine, and the last one was Novavax's vaccine. What's the difference? Go and tell us the difference in the vaccines and what you think will help, will evolve.
Well, so the difference between the mRNA vaccine, so Pfizer and Moderna, or the Novavax vaccine, the Novavax vaccine is made the way we have had a lot of experience making vaccines, which is you just take one critical protein of the virus, in this case, it's the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, and essentially have a purified single protein vaccine. That's the way we make the hepatitis B vaccine, the human papillomavirus vaccine. So we have a lot of experience with those kinds of vaccines. We had no experience with messenger RNA as a vaccine because you're not giving the virus, either as a weakened form of the virus or as a whole killed form of the virus or as a single protein of the virus, you're giving a gene that codes for one of the viral proteins, and then your cells make that protein. So we had no experience with that, which is why it was so surprising. I think we isolated and sequenced this virus in January of 2020. 11 months later, using a technology that we never used before, we had two large clinical trials that showed the vaccine was safe, and then we mass administered it quickly to 70% of this population. I think it was the greatest scientific or medical accomplishment in my lifetime, and my lifetime includes the development of the polio vaccine. I think the frustration here, and it's really the reason I wrote the book because it was largely cathartic, is what happened then? By July of 2021, we hit a wall. 30% of this country refused to be vaccinated. So even though you had a ticket out of this pandemic, people made that choice. 300,000 people died because they made that choice. And that, to me, was just a striking contrast. You're in this wealthy, technologically advanced country which could do that, could make that kind of vaccine. At the same time, you have a significant portion of the population that just didn't trust the FDA. They didn't trust the CDC. They didn't trust public health agencies. They didn't trust their physicians or nurses. And they said, not for me. That's in large part why I wrote the book. What happened? Why did this happen?
So going forward, will we use the mRNA mainly for prevention of cancer and maybe new diseases and go back to traditional vaccines for this? In other words, the reason I went to the Novavax is I figured for the mRNA was enough for me for a while. I should go and try a traditional vaccine. I don't know whether that had any rationale, but I knew that the traditional vaccines were pretty safe. And I think it's important. People ask, are the vaccines safe? And the answer is, no thing in medicine is absolutely safe, but it still has I always say it's like going to the roulette table, putting down a dollar for the childhood vaccines, and you're going to either get 40,000 back or lose your dollar. There isn't anyone I know who wouldn't take the 40,000 to one shot. And that's what the benefit of the childhood, when you look at the data, and Dr. Oz and I literally looked at the data and came to the conclusion it was a 40,000 to one shot, and did a lot of campaigning on getting parents to vaccinate their kids. I'm worried that we're not getting enough, that some of the blowback on the COVID-19 has had a spillover effect, which is very damaging for kids' health. We saw an epidemic of measles in Ohio. I think I just heard of another epidemic, and I think it was measles in Texas. And it seems to me that it's almost like we have made so much progress. I mean, it's almost like we need Taylor Swift to get vaccinated on TV the way Elvis did way back when.
I think you're exactly right. I think what happened in this pandemic is the opposite of what I would have imagined. I would have imagined that vaccines would have been seen for what they were, which is a hero. But quite the opposite. What happened is, I think when we mandated vaccines, when people lost their jobs, when they couldn't go to their favorite bar or restaurant or couldn't go to a place of worship or a sporting event, and they were forced really perceive themselves as being forced to be vaccinated, well, I think we leaned into a libertarian left hook. And so now what you're seeing is hundreds and hundreds of pieces of legislation pushing back on public health initiatives like isolation or quarantine or masking or vaccines, and which I think many ways will make us less prepared in some ways for the next pandemic. But that's what happened here. And as a consequence, about 25% of American parents now say that they wonder whether we really should have school vaccine mandates. mandates. And you have now a study that came out of the CDC showing that a greater percentage of kindergartners were now, or the parents of those kindergartners were choosing philosophical exemptions or religious exemptions to vaccine, non-medical exemptions to vaccines. And that was like the highest it had been. So there is an erosion in vaccine rates in kids. And with that, you're seeing exactly what you would expect. Measles is always the first to come back. And it's hard to watch because there's so much in medicine we can't do. There's so much we don't know. This we know. This we can do. And to watch people reject it and put their children in harm's way unnecessarily is hard.
And we should say that these childhood diseases, measles and rubella and mumps, are not benign diseases. Clearly, polio isn't a benign disease. We almost wiped polio out. Now I'm a little afraid it's coming back. And you have that interesting story in the book about the person, I think it was in New York, someplace in upstate New York or maybe Long Island, that was paralyzed from polio. I like the story of Elvis. I use it in all my talks about Elvis changed the health of America because his biggest contribution wasn't his music, but was using the popularity to get vaccinated on TV live. You don't go into it in enough depth, I think, because it was carried, although it was on an Ed Sullivan show, which I think was CBS. His vaccination was carried live on ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS. And we went from 0.23% of the population eligible to be vaccinated, being vaccinated before he got it, to roughly 70, I think it was 73% of the population were vaccinated within 8 months of being on TV. So he really wiped out polio and saves us $75 billion a year, if you will, assuming that he did that in polio treatment. I think we need to lean on Taylor Swift or someone of her popularity to, or maybe Kelsey can do it, that is to break the logjam on people understanding how important vaccination is.
So you're right. Celebrities have an enormous platform. Many of them use that platform for the public good, but not all.
Do you know of anything else that's going to change this? I mean, I'm really, in adults, I can talk about inflammation and about breaking away plaques and causing heart disease, strokes, memory loss, and other serious problems. But for kids, they don't have plaques in their arteries yet. And the parents, because of the vaccination in the past, haven't seen the mental dysfunction, haven't seen the serious problems from measles and mumps and rubella and the other childhood diseases. We've been lucky enough to avoid it, and most of them hopefully won't experience it. But I don't know how to motivate. You've had a lot of experience now. What do you, other than the catharsis of writing a great book? The great book is Tell Me When It's Over, An Expert's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World. It's published by National Geo, a division of Disney. So maybe we can get the mouse to get vaccinated or something. I don't even know. I mean, he might get outlawed in Florida if he did that. But anyway, I don't know what you've had a lot of experience. Are you hopeful that we're going to be able to turn this around, or are you worried?
Well, worried, but I do think there's two ways to turn it around. The best way is that you educate people about the importance of the disease, how devastating the disease can be, and about how successful the vaccine is and how safe the vaccine is. So that's one way, is education. The other way, and this is the worst way, is that, once again, children will suffer these diseases or be hospitalized with these diseases or go to the intensive care unit. It's true with measles. I mean, get to a couple thousand cases of measles in this country, you'll see children starting to die again. And that will get people's attention, I think. But, you know, you would like to think it wouldn't have to come to that to get people's attention, because we don't fear measles. And I think worse, not only have we largely eliminated measles, we've eliminated the memory of measles. People don't remember how sick that virus makes you.
Yeah. I'm hoping it's not that. I want to thank you. We are brought to you every week. That is the Owner's Manual podcast. This is 1190B. We're brought to you every week by longevityplaybook.com. Go there and sign up for the free newsletter, 250 words plus a cartoon a week to help you stay younger. as well as by Life's First Naturals, the makers of both TruBiotics and Bovine Colostrum. You can go there and see their randomized double-blind controlled studies on when it is beneficial. Thank you, Dr. Offit, for all you do for America, for all you do for helping us understand, and for writing what I'll tell you I think is a wonderful book, Tell Me When It's Over, An Expert's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World. And hopefully, my hope is that COVID only modifies into a more benevolent set of SARS viruses and protects us against all other SARS viruses. In any case, thank you. And I hope one of these days, and I know you have written a book in the past about this, we should talk about how to protect ourselves from pandemics in the future. That is what we should do as a country that we aren't doing. I have a fear of that as well. So thank you very much. Dr. Offit is at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, a great institution. And thank you, our listeners. You're the one that motivated us to keep doing this. Tell your friends about us, rate us, and give us topics. You know how to get in touch with us. Give us topics. You can always email me at my email, drmikerealage@gmail.com. Thanks again. We'll be back next week. We hope you are.